I know many of you are still finishing up and now working on desserts, but it's time to get going with our program. I'd just like to take a quick minute to introduce today's host, Mark Gerentzer. There's a lot of things I would like to be able to say about Mark, but then he'd shoot me. So what I am allowed to say is after his 31-year career at Booz Allen Hamilton, where he was the recognized strategy and technology expert, he moved on and now it serves as chairman of the board of BENS, which is Business Executives for National Security. As such, he has made many contacts through his career, and now the Forum Club is very fortunate to have him as a member because he's introducing these members to us. So, Mark.
Thank you, President Wessel. Welcome, Collier County, amazing Collier County High School students from the Village School and the MCA. And good afternoon, colleagues and friends of the Forum Club. Today you're going to leave here probably knowing a little bit more about national security, and I think you're probably going to leave a little more afraid too, so we'll see. It's my honor and pleasure to introduce to you someone I admired greatly throughout my government and industry career, General Keith Alexander. As with most four-star generals, he began his career at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, including following some noteworthy peers to include Martin Dempsey, who became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and David Petraeus, who was the head of Central Command and also the director of CIA. So that was some peer group he was with. But the general went on and furthered his education, receiving several master's degrees, including one in electronic warfare from the Naval Postgraduate School. Now, how many people in this room have a master's degree in electronic warfare? Raise your hand. All right. Most of us would find it somewhat career limiting, but not for Keith. Today, his picture hangs in the school's Hall of Fame. That's an Army guy in an Army uniform hanging in the Naval Postgraduate School's Hall of Fame. Quite amazing. Now, I'm not going to read you his bio because I know you all have done your homework. I'd rather tell you some things that aren't in his public bio, so let me proceed there. First, General Alexander culminated his career in a rare dual-hatted role. He was director of the National Security Agency and was the catalyst and first commander of the United States Cyber Command. Now, if you were here in December when Jessica Buchanan was speaking, she was the NGO worker rescued by SEAL Team 6 in East Africa. You'd be interested to know that it was General Alexander and his intelligence apparatus that found her, tracked her. And gave that SEAL team the precise geolocation coordinates for her rescue. So that was awesome, General. But I'll have to tell you, the establishment of the Cyber Command is no less significant. Cyber Command was highly transformative for our nation, but not an easy task to achieve. Keith ultimately had to convince President Barack Obama that we needed a unified command to protect, project, and win in this new area or domain of warfare called cyber. Martin Dempsey told me that the general used a basketball analogy with the president to make the point and close the deal. Maybe we'll hear about that. But this is why many believe Keith Alexander singularly made the greatest contributions to our nation's cyber capabilities, including integrating cyber defense, offense, and exploitation activities into our military operations. In my circles, Keith is considered the Billy Mitchell of cyber. Now, I first met General Alexander when he was a major. We had a common mentor that made that introduction. And even as a major, Keith Alexander was seen as a rock star with unlimited potential. To his credit, he was a master at comprehending complex technical topics. And he had the great gift of being able to explain those topics to non-technical people like members of Congress. By the way, that earned him the nickname Alexander the Geek. So the kid who grew up in a suburb of Syracuse, third of five children, really made a difference for our nation. His dad was a Marine. And I often wonder how that first conversation went when you told your dad you were joining the Army. That had to be something. Keith married his lovely wife, whom he met, but I am told, did not date in high school. My guess was that Debbie simply wasn't interested in him at the time, but I don't really know. As for our mutual mentor, Lieutenant General Tom Weinstein, Tom was helping me transition from government activities into industry at the same time he was mentoring Keith's ascension in the Army. General Alexander and I benefited greatly from Tom, and we both miss him and his colorful language. Finally, I had the pleasure of observing General Alexander up close and personal at the National Security Agency as a special government employee there during his tenure and as one of the plank holders who created the Cyber Center for Education and Innovation. I had the privilege of engaging the director every so often. General, thanks for joining us today. We look forward to your remarks.
So first of all, for all the high school kids that are here, great. What you guys are doing is amazing. We were just talking about, I was lucky to get out of high school. I had a choice, get in the Army or go to jail. Okay, maybe not that, but, and I saw we had some from Lebanon. One of my first bosses was from Lebanon, Fadlo Masabni. It was great, and then Debbie and I were in Ukraine, Elmira, not too long ago. So what you guys do in community service, I'm going to come back to. It's amazing. You should be very proud of it. It's going to stick with you the rest of your life, and most of the people in this room are doing just that, helping the community, helping our nation grow. I'm going to talk for the next 3 hours. No, just kidding. We have a clock here. I'm going to talk about where our nation is today in terms of, I believe, a crisis in terms of warfare and what's going on in the Middle East and what we face in the future. So there's so much to tell. So how do you bring together China, Russia, Iran, the Middle East, Hezbollah, and all that? So I'm going to try to do a good job on this and just tell you that they're all going to work together as an axis of evil in the future, and they're doing so now. So put that first and foremost in your mind. I'm going to go back to 1979 when Iran, the revolution that went on, and what happened in Iran in 1979 in terms of going after the embassy when we didn't release the Shah back, and Iran's hatred for Israel and the fact that they wanted to eradicate it. In 1982, they sent 1,500 people into Lebanon to help Hezbollah get formed. Hezbollah has the same approach about eradicating Israel, and they are one of the three that we'll talk about in further. Remember, they went after the embassy in 82, the Marine Corps barracks bombing in 83, 1996, Khobar Towers. So a bad group from our perspective. Hamas, another bad group, I'm going to come back to them, but 1982, while all this is going on, recognize that Iran and Iraq are at war. Iraq is being equipped by Russia. And Iran was going to be equipped by Russia. So giving out arms to two warring parties, I guess, is good business because you can win on both sides. One of them is going to win or have a draw, but they sold a lot of equipment. I bring that up because that brings Russia into the neighborhood. And if you followed some of the recent stuff, there's concern about Russia displacing the United States in Iraq with a Shia focus, that's Iran. So word, bad things to come in that area. So as you go through this and you think about all that's transpired, the 1990, so you had the Iraq-Iran War, 1980 to 88,
1990 Desert Storm. Saddam Hussein made a bad choice in going down to Kuwait, paid for it. I was in Desert Storm, 1st Armored Division, G2. It's amazing how good our military is. So for all of the high school adults now going to college, think about going into the Army, not the Navy, because the Navy will hang your poster up at the Navy postgraduate school and put mustaches on. Okay. So, and make fun of you. Actually, it's a great school. The Navy postgraduate school was amazing. So when you think about all of the stuff that's going on, 1990, and we step forward, 96, Khobar Towers, 98, the East Africa Embassy bombings. So where was I in 1998? We had just arrived, 1 August, 1998, to Central Command. And we thought, wow, this is great. You know, we're in Florida. It's amazing. The sun. We're going to have a great time. 7 August, what happens? The East Africa Embassy bombings. I didn't see the sun for the next 3 years. We worked. 2 weeks later was the Infinite Resolve going after the guys that did the East Africa Embassy bombings, including bin Laden, who was at Coast when they were hit, but he had left an hour earlier. Somebody had given him a heads up from the Pakistani military. So all this is going on, and the reason I bring that up is the Middle East is a tinderbox. We can jump forward to Hamas 7 October. And when you look at what Hamas did, I'm helping a coalition for the families of the victims and hostages. I talked to all the U.S. dual citizens that are over there with families, and it's horrific to hear what happened. Most of the people killed were not armed, were young students who were at a music festival, and the way they were killed, without weapons, they were brutally killed or murdered or maimed, and all these bad things. When you look at it, Hamas took the approach that if we kill more people, Israel will come out and do a lot of bad things to Gaza, and the world will be on our side. I'm going to step back and say, so prior to that, in September, 500 Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas got training in Iran for this specific target. On 2 October, it said that Kayani, who heads the Islamic Republican Guards Corps CODS force, took over for Soleimani. He said good to go on 2 October. I believe that Hamas jumped the gun and attacked before others could join in, because I believe if it had been Palestinian Islamic Jihad from the West Bank and from Lebanon, Hezbollah, it would have been a whole different ballgame. I think it surprised some of the leadership in Iran and Hamas, especially Haniya. He did not know that it was going to go until it did happen. Sinwar, who is the representative in Gaza, and Mohammed Daif were the ones that orchestrated the attack and the timing and had them go. And over 1,200 people were killed that day. And when you look at the size of Israel compared to the U.S., that would be like 10,000 of our people. And it's not going to end there. It's getting worse. You look at what's going on between Hezbollah and Lebanon. You look at what's going on between Hamas and what's going on with the Houthis, all supported by Iran. And Iran has a nexus with both Russia and China. So I'm going to talk briefly about that, and you can make sure when I get to the right point, but I want to get through this. When you look at it, Russia, we talked about Russia's involvement with Iran, and they stay there, and Russia's involvement in the region. Today is 2 years for the war in Ukraine. Today is the 2 years. I know my old place is doing a lot of work on that, and you're seeing some of that in the papers. And it was revealed by the Deputy Secretary of Defense that a lot of the information prior to the war came from Nakasone and the team up there. Having said that, if the U.S. continues to support Ukraine, there is a way to help Ukraine stop Russia there. If the U.S. backs out, I believe Russia will be given a go signal, and this will change Europe, Eastern Europe, and we have a big problem. So it reminds me of World War II, and just to be clear, I was not in World War II. Many of you can appreciate that line of humor. But when you think about what happened in World War II, 1938, Chamberlain made the mistake of saying you can have part of Czechoslovakia. We cannot tell Putin he can have part of Ukraine. One, it's not ours to give. It's Ukraine. And two, as soon as you do that, it's just like Crimea. He came back after 8 years from Crimea, and he's there now. Think about this. He's going to take more. And he benefits, Russia benefits, by having us pinned down in the Middle East. But the biggest problem people are going to talk about is, what about China? Where's China in all this? China signed a $400 billion 25-year deal with Iran for oil, money to Iran. Iran uses a lot of that money to pay Hamas, to pay Hezbollah, to pay the Fatah, and to pay the Houthis. It's going to terrorism. And China's goal, they're kind of in the midst of, how do I do this? Xi Jinping, it's interesting, if you look back to 2012 when he took over, he did a few things when he took charge. He said, I will never let China be embarrassed like we were in World War II. That will never happen. And as a consequence, we're going to build our military, and it'll be the best military in the world by 2050, and we're going to have one China, we're going to take back Taiwan. Those two things. So he's on that, and you'll see stuff in the press even as late as this week talking about his desire to take over Taiwan. They have an approach to taking over Taiwan as follows. If the U.S. were involved, they would attack the United States in cyber. Okay, so I had a chance to run our nation's offense. It's always good to be on offense, so I think when you're in soccer, it's good to be on offense, right? You want to be on the offense, right? It's always good to be on offense. When the department got hacked, we detected and solved that problem. Secretary Gates said, you know, I got a letter from on 11 November, Veterans Day. It's ironic that you've been running the offense, and now you're going to run the defense. We're going to set up a new command. You'll be in the job, your three-year job, for a little bit longer. I served 9 years in that job. And many people say, why did you serve that long? And they said, you had to stay until you got it right. So it took me longer than most. But having said that, he asked me this one question. How often are you successful on the offense? And the answer was 100% of the time. We're not the only good ones. So here's the issue our nation faces. You can have a great offense. People can shoot really good. They can do things to bad guys. How do we defend the world's greatest technical infrastructure here, the United States? How do we defend that? That's where Cyber Command started to come in and what we're trying to do to set that up. Because Russia, SVR, attack into SolarWinds, was actually them trying to get information about the GRU's attack in 2017 against Ukraine tax stuff. And remember, that got out and wiped out FedEx and a bunch of other big companies, Maersk and all those. All these guys were hit with that, a destructive virus. They wanted to know in 21 who was going to be sanctioned, and did it go up to Putin? So they got all the way in, and their target was Department of Justice. That's my belief. I have no classified information on it, but I'm really good at reading the tea leaves, having been in Intel for 40 years. So my comment is, that's what they were after. and they got in to 9 different agencies, including the Department of Justice. Now think about our infrastructure and where we are. We have a long ways to go in fixing cyber. We really do. When you think about it, everybody goes, I have these great discussions with all these cyber experts in these companies, and their first thing is, you don't understand, we spend a lot of money. I said, that's really good. You know, can you imagine a bank saying they spend a lot of money when the guys who are robbing the bank is called SEAL Team 6? We spend a lot of money. We have these guards. They go through extra training. And you think, SEAL Team 6, nah, it's probably not going to work for you. Well, that's what we face in cyber. Our industry faces the equivalent of SEAL Team 6s. And we have no way of connecting the government and industry together today. So that's one thing we got to fix and that we're pushing on. So when you look at that, what's that mean for our future? And what do I think is going to happen? I am greatly concerned that as you put all these pieces on the table, what Xi Jinping's doing, what Putin's doing, what Khamenei is doing, what's going on in Iran and in the Middle East, it's going to start in the Middle East and it's going to grow. How do you keep it from becoming a war, a regional war, with Russia and the U.S. involved and the impact of Russia and the U.S. vis-a-vis Ukraine? And if China were to try to take Taiwan, we have a global war. I bring that up because I'm not a student of history. I am a great technical person, but there are some history people in the students here. So if you go back to history and you look at where we were, and there's great statements in 1900 by the Great Britain saying, there will never be another war because we are so interconnected internationally. There'll never be another war. That was 1900, 2 world wars later. We think there can't be a war because look at where we are. We're in Naples, Florida. Look at how great our life is. That's not the way they see it. That's not the way Iran sees it. That's not the way the terrorist groups see it. That's not the way Russia sees it. And that's not the way China sees it. From their perspective is Russia and China have territorial objectives, Taiwan and Eastern Europe, as does Iran. And when you look at Iran, Iraq, Syria, and what's going on there, this could be a big challenge. So for the young folks from high school, because more than likely, some of you, if this happens, you will end up being like our folks, our young people were prior to World War II. You're going to end up in the Army, hopefully. Not the Navy, but the Army. Or the Air Force. Okay, but preferably the Army. It's going to change. And we have to be ready for that because our national survival, I think, depends on it. The second part is if you went to Syria 30 years ago in the mid-80s, it was a wonderful place. You could go all of Damascus, all the things that were going on. It was amazing. I had a friend who was the attaché there. They used to go down to the coffee shops. All the things were great. Look what's happened. Almost destroyed. We can't let that happen here. So, how do we stop it? I do believe we have a choice. Am I close? Okay. Good. I'm good. Okay. Because normally I get that, and that's from my wife. I mean, stop. So, when you think about what's happening, what's going to happen here? I am concerned that this is going to grow and it's going to get out of control. And that starts everything. And it's going to be worse than we expected. The biggest issue that we face and that I faced when I was in the military was what happens if Iran gets a nuclear weapon? Okay? And the reason that I worried about it are both administrations that I work with, the Bush and the Obama administrations were worried about it is Iran said if they got one, they would use it on Israel. And the Israelis believed them, rightfully so. And the question is, how far are they from a nuclear weapon? Or does somebody help them get one? Add North Korea into that mix. And if that happens, that changes the whole framework of what we're doing. And everybody goes, you know, we can say that's crazy, right? But think about going into a music festival and just gunning down kids who are unarmed. That's crazy too. That was their objective, to just send a message. That's what concerns me. I have 16 grandchildren. I know I don't look that old, thank you. My wife doesn't either, so we can talk later. Okay, so when you think about it, what worries me is about what we're leaving our children and our grandchildren, our country. And how do we put the right people in to make the decisions that we're going to need to make, not only for our economy, but for the world? I believe, having been around it, that with all the problems that we have, if the United States doesn't get involved, it's going to go bad. We shouldn't have to pay for everything. I think we should help Zelensky in Ukraine. Better to pay them to stop that than to send our divisions over. We need to help Israel in their fight. And I'm not against the Palestinian people. I am against the terrorist groups and the ones that hide behind it. If you think about some of those terrorist groups. Haniyeh, who runs the Hamas, lived in Qatar, and you've read about that. What you may not know is he and the top two guys that were with him have $11 billion. They get it by taxing stuff coming in to Gaza and taking the money from the same people who need it. Think about that. $11 billion they have. That's a lot, right? That's probably $10,000 per person in Gaza. That would have solved parts of this problem. So they're stealing from it. They're making money, and the people, the Palestinian people, are being killed. They push them out in front of this. So there's no easy way out. There's no right and wrong, from my perspective, in terms of how you address it. But we have to get involved and help make sure it stops here. So that's my thoughts. I was going to talk one thing about Jessica Buchanan. Is that all right? So it was interesting. Jessica Buchanan, as you may know, was sick. She talked a little bit about that. But what she didn't know is that got into the State Department through probably intel sources, or so I heard. We track our agency, my old agency, tracks all hostages of the U.S. and our allies. And every week I'd get a briefing on the 60-plus that were around the world being held hostage. When State Department called Defense Department and said, hey, you need to do a mission and go get Jessica Buchanan because she will die in captivity if we don't rescue her. And that went to SEAL Team 6. Joe Votel, who was the JSOC commander at the time, called up and said, where is she? And that's what we did. We helped them do that, and we helped the team go in. It's amazing the things that our nation does to help one person, Jessica Buchanan. When you think about it, we would do that for any person. And when you think about the number of people that are working at NSA, at CIA, in the Gulf, that are helping that, we had a few hundred people there working at that part. Our part was to make sure that SEAL Team 6 could get in and get out safe. Same thing on Bin Laden, same thing on all these things. We have great capabilities that we all help pay for. And we have a great quality of life. If we want to maintain that quality of life, I believe we're going to have to step in vis-a-vis Ukraine. And so please come on up. I'll take some questions, make them easy. You got none? No questions?
Thank you, General. That was brilliant. And I have to tell you, there were more questions here than I've ever seen. So I'm going to combine some. Let me combine this one. This has a couple of students' questions. What does the future of cybersecurity look like with the evolving face of warfare? And have any cyber threats been eliminated personally? And what keeps you up at night?
Well, so there's so many things. I'm not going to go into the X-rated what keeps me up at night, all right? So we can't talk about that. All right, so there's an active cyber war going on today. I mean, just think about it. It's not like everybody's waiting for something to happen. You read about the Chinese being in our infrastructure, the Russians doing this, the U.S. doing this. There's a war going on in cyber already, and you read about that. And from my perspective, the biggest part that we played in was going after terrorism, and cyber was an exceptional way to do that. So, yes, there is. Now, has there been active campaigns? Yes. Think about the elections 2018, 2020, and 2022. They talked about protecting the elections and what Cyber Command did to help in those. The Deputy Secretary of Defense at the change of command actually gave them credit for helping to protect our elections. So there are things and there are ways to do that. And do they use offensive tools? Yeah. Yes. But we're the good guys.
Yep, good guys. Here's a few questions around NSA now, and I'll toggle back and forth. And I'm going to combine these also. How important is it that the FISA Act be renewed? FISA stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It came out of the Church Commission. And then on that, General, how will NSA stay ahead with the advent of AI, and what kind of threats does quantum pose for NSA?
Those are easy questions. Easy piece of cake. So the 702 Act, which is up for reauthorization, allows the government to track a call from a terrorist or a known terrorist into the U.S. and see what's going on in the U.S. That happened on 9/11. There were calls from Yemen into California, but they weren't allowed to track those. So that the people on the foreign side couldn't tell the people in the country that something's going on, and they didn't have the authority to then link those two together. That's called connecting the dots. It would be the dumbest thing that we ever did to say, you can't track a terrorist call coming into the U.S. You have to go get a warrant on X, Y, and Z. And the answer is, who here has received a call from a terrorist? Please raise your hand. Nobody? Okay, so you know now if you are receiving calls from a terrorist, isn't that odd? Shouldn't the FBI be able to look at that? Shouldn't we be able to say, what are you up to? Are you planning an event here? And the answer is yes, absolutely. My understanding, I talked to some of the senior members of Congress, they are going to push that. That's, I think, very important.
Yeah.
Vis-a-vis quantum. A lot of work to go into quantum, the entanglement. I did do a degree in physics, too, so quantum mechanics was one of my areas. Now, having said that, I think it's still a ways off to actually have quantum computing. I think it's going to be a hybrid quantum and conventional computer. And the issue is, can you crack the codes faster? Yes. And so that means we'll have to look at quantum resistance cryptology for the future. I think you're going to see a lot happening over the next 4 years in this area, not yet to quantum, to real quantum computer. What was the question in the middle?
AI.
AI. What's that, Army Intel?
It's artificial intelligence, which is the opposite of natural stupidity.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, that's right. There's NS and AI. So artificial intelligence is going to be a game changer by pulling a lot of stuff together and bringing it. We, the Intel community, has been working with that. I talked to some of the folks from IBM since my time, so over the past 20 years, the evolution of machine learning and AI for things like Watson. So you've all seen Watson, right? Had roots at NSA. So when you think about that, it's, yes, I think that's all going to be involved. We are blessed with the people that we have in the intelligence community at NSA. Over 1,000 PhDs. I know Penny's here from, where's Penny? Raise your hand. Penny was at NSA. It's the most amazing group of people that are concerned with taking care of this country. So honor and privilege to be there.
Super. Thank you, General. Here's a set of questions. I'm going to combine them as well that talk about technology, and in particular, chips made in China, Chinese equipment used by consumers, and just advances in technology. And how's that changing our concern in view of cyber and cyber, what Cyber Command needs to do?
So the big concern about chips in China is them putting in something that allows them to change code, right? So, and given their expertise in hacking our infrastructure, if it's their chips and they have a way of doing it, or if it's their systems, Huawei, which way? Huawei. Say with me. If you think Huawei, that's why we push back on Huawei. You put their infrastructure into AT&T, Verizon, everything, they've got it easy into every one of our calls. Same thing for chips. So I believe setting up our own chip stuff here is important. I was talking to a few folks earlier. I think we should also look at investing in Latin America and South America, building out clothes and stuff and things that are done in China. Have that done and give them a job there and move it all to a local area. It'll help us on immigration, helps them, and it solves some of the problems with China.
Super.
It's a paid non-political level.
Question here, and I'll go to the Mideast. There's several questions here. What is your professional opinion for the best approach of peace to ensure stability for future generations, and how can we help the King Abdullah of Jordan in his efforts to care and house refugees from Syria and Palestine, and what should our U.S. strategy be in the Middle East?
I think the most important thing we can do in the Middle East is with respect to the Abraham Accords. The Abraham Accords starts to align the Gulf states with Israel. And this is extremely important because it now builds that all together. The pushback is Qatar hosting Hamas, Saudi Arabia's involvement or potential involvement or stickiness with not only Khashoggi but 9/11 has to be resolved to get there. I think that's going to be a diplomatic push. I think there's a way to get through that, but get that set up. Set up a Gulf NATO, if you will, that can counter Iran, because they're all getting hit by Iran. If you look at the drone attacks on Saudi Arabia, UAE, the attacks going on, they're getting hammered and they're getting crushed in cyber. So put that together and stop that. I think that's the way to do it. That starts it. We don't have to be we could just be a partner. We don't have to put a lot of resources in. They have the money to put the resources in. What we can do is just say, we're here to help.
This is a more of a political question, but I think it's one you should address. Please discuss the balance, because there's a perspective people have from the media. Please discuss the balance of intelligence agencies having too much power versus politicians having too much control over these agencies. What would you comment about that?
Wow, somebody made a comment about working with Congress. True story. I was in a hearing, and one of the congressmen asked one of the Air Force 3-stars, who was putting a bunch of F-18s into Guam, won't it tip it over? True story. And the guy didn't break out laughing. I was sitting there trying not to. And the nope, it's well grounded there. It's well grounded. Is there too much power? I think the balance is good. I think what's bad today, to be honest, and you all see this, is the parties are too far apart. It used to be, I had the great opportunity to go up to Congress when it was Ted Stevens and Danny Inouye, Democrat and Republican. We had a big problem, and it was actually working for Weinstein and company and follow on. And I went down, I sat, and I briefed him on this problem, and Ted Stevens turned to Danny and we said, we can solve this, can't we, Danny? And he said, yeah, and it was done. Two people, adults, doing what's right for the country, not looking at it from a political perspective. That's what we got to do.
Great. So here's a good one from a student. Is there a place for applied mathematics in cybersecurity?
Yes, absolutely.
Simply.
So I'll tell you that in math, some of the most amazing things are happening in math AI, quantum computing, all the applied mathematics that go with it, signaling, you will see some of that over the next few years. It will be some of the most, and I had a chance to work with all these PhDs in mathematics. They're very, very smart, and they solve problems, some of which they can't tell the world that they've solved because it helps us defend this nation. So yeah, if you're good in math, what I would recommend, apply to NSA in your freshman year of college. You can get an internship. And as Penny would say, it was the most amazing place. You know, you hear what you read in the press? Don't believe that. You want to save people's lives and see it? Go there. It's amazing.
Thank you. What was your most fulfilling experience in the Army or national security, and who was the best example of a leader that you through your whole career?
Okay, so I'm going to give you my story on leadership. You know, people don't realize that the director of NSA also goes to all the National Security Council meetings, right? And when they deal with terrorism or military or all that. When it deals with political stuff, we don't go. But all the important stuff, we would go to. So I knew President Bush well. I knew President Obama well. President Bush was coming up to Fort Meade, and I asked the driver, the Secret Service guy, said, so where do I sit? Do I sit in his car or do I go in mine? He goes, General, this is really easy. The president tells you to get in his car, get in his car. If he doesn't, get in your car. I'm an Army guy. I can work with that. So the helicopters come up, and he lands, and I welcome Fort Meade, and boom, there he goes. General, get in the car. We got to talk. I thought, wow, okay. So we get to his car. He gets in the jump seat. I'm in his seat. I think, how cool is that? Where are the photographers? There's none. I didn't get that. We lived across the street. Well, it was a big parade field, so you couldn't really see it. So he goes, General, there are two problems that we have. One, they tell me you have too many bosses. And I thought, danger, Will Robinson. I have seven bosses. The president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, the director of national intelligence, the undersecretary of defense for intel, commander Stratcom, and the chairman of the joint chiefs. All of them outranked me. Who do you tell the president is no good and live? I looked the president right in the eye and told him, actually, they're all helpful. And they were. Even Rumsfeld, who I have a note on my door, don't joke with Rumsfeld. He doesn't have a sense of humor. I did. And it was great. I called up when I needed to see the president or the vice president. I called directly to the White House or had my people do it. I needed to see the vice president on something. The next morning I was in his office at 9:30. They made time. Just like that. Drive right up, get out, West Wing. It was great. I can't do that anymore, so just to be clear. But the greatest act of leadership was his second thing. And he said, this terrorist surveillance program, which is the Act 702 that's currently being debated, is out in the press. 2006, New York Times, remember that was coming out in the press. And he said, this is going to be really bad. This is going to be terrible. Here's what we're going to do. You defend the country, I'll take the heat. And he did, every step of the way. Here's a politician who then got up in front of the American people with me, Cheney, McConnell, and one other standing behind him and said, his program to defend the American people. He authorized it. We're going to do these things with it. That's what we need, are politicians who will stand up for what's right for the country, take the heat, and he did. Remember, he got crucified in the press about all that, and then it went away. We need people who can do that, not for their own, but for good. And I'll tell you, you know, it was interesting. Having worked with President Bush and being there with seeing the relationship between he and Condoleezza Rice and all this, everybody says, you know, he wasn't that smart. It's not true. He was amazing with people. He listened, and he took the advice of his cabinet. And he was really good. You don't have to be the smartest person in the room. When I was at NSA, there were 1,000 people smarter than me in math, for sure, right? You don't have to be the smartest person in the room. you can be a good person and a great leader. And so for the young folks that are here, I think the best thing that you can do is figure out leadership. How do you get people to do something that they wouldn't ordinarily do to accomplish a mission? That's what the military is about. You can't convince somebody to go take a hill when they're shooting at you. Please go take the hill. We'll give you a bonus this week. The guy's thinking, I'm not going to live going up that hill. We need some more. Yeah. Let's vote.
Very good.
It doesn't happen. All right.
Beth, can we go a little longer? One more. Okay, I just want to say, by the way, Donald Rumsfeld, one of the toughest guys to brief, thought the world of this dude and recognized his integrity and intelligence and made him the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the Army, the number one position in Army Intel, which propelled your career, I believe, further. So,
yeah, so there's a story here. So there's a story, just if I could. So Abu Ghraib, the interrogation operations were run by the ops officer, not by the intel officer. I was the intel officer, as you said, 2004. Abu Ghraib hits this hockey puck, comes down the corridor in the Pentagon and says, you're now in charge of interrogation operations. You have a meeting with Secretary Rumsfeld in 2 hours. The G3 dumped all that on. So I went up, found out I was the briefer. That's how you find out. So, you know, be prepared. A Boy Scout, we have some Boy Scouts here. So be prepared, right? And the answer, so I ended up briefing Rumsfeld on interrogation operations. He said, great, I want you to go over to Congress and talk to them. You'll follow Cambone in the commercial sector. Cambone, you may know, was somebody who thought highly of himself.
Yes.
He's a brilliant guy, but he thought he was a smart.
Steve Cambone.
So he goes in there, and he comes out. He was actually sweating, and I'm in the back room. Now, I do have a sense of humor. I just broke out. I said, you got crucified. He said, we got destroyed. You got to change your speech going up. I said, look, it's all printed out. I'm not going to change it. I got this all set. It's all set. He said, you got to change it. So we end up changing mine 8 minutes before we go out. So I go out there. I do have a sense of humor, as you now know. And I'm being asked all these questions, and a senator on the right hand, I can still see the senator there today, asks a question of, why don't we hold the MI officer who ran the garrison at Abu Ghraib accountable? I said, well, Senator, you know Fort Drum. The garrison commander runs the garrison, but the 10th Mountain Division commander runs the division. The garrison commander can't tell the division commander what to do. And at Abu Ghraib, the intel officer runs Abu Ghraib. The MP officer runs the prison. So I made a few other jokes about some things I know I probably shouldn't have. And so I get back to my office. I'm sitting down thinking, I maybe shouldn't have made some of those humorous things. I get a call from Rumsfeld. Come up to my office. I thought, which one wasn't funny? And who was it that ratted me out? Which senator? I get up there and he goes, General, I don't know what you did, but I got a call from three senators. You're the only one they understood. Here's the deal. You're going to represent the department on all the meetings on Abu Ghraib on the Hill.
What a great gift.
I ended up doing 125 meetings with Congress, but it got me NSA.
Lightning round. Real just comment. Two questions, and this one should have been for General Raymond. Anything to say about the balloon China flew over us, and what's the chance of an EMP attack?
I think an EMP attack first. There's a chance of an EMP attack. I think that's
electromagnetic pulse.
Against that would destroy computers and hardware. I think there's a chance of that for both weapons and other things, but I think that would be. They'd have to do a nuclear blast over the U.S. to do something like that, and that would, of course, not be a good thing. What was the first part of that?
The China balloon.
The China balloon. I'm surprised that they spy on us.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be either. They spy. We spy. They got caught. That was stupid. I mean, doing a balloon like that and just dumb. But you got to admit that they're tenacious about spying on us for a reason. They want to know what we're doing and how prepared we are if a war goes on. And they're going to collect that information.
Can we thank the general for his remarks? Yep.
You did a great job.
Thanks.
Thank you.